time that I talk about the host over the ramp, cause hoes these days ain't nothing nice. Remember that phrase? 9 out of 10 get socked in the nose. That's some true shit that only come out from the money. But black tea can't be played for no dummy. I'm from the EPA streets, I got much game. To them, it might sound the same. But if there's a woman that will be there for you and not for the money, maybe black tea will be there for you. But until then, no flow for the hoes. Chilling at a club, watching this hoe spit a game to a brother. I see it unfold, cause I know the deal. You took her hand, and you are on the way. So she had a friend with her, she asked if she could come. You didn't wanna be rude, so you say okay to them, to the movies, and then to a motel. You got butt naked and fucked them both until you fell asleep. The next day you woke up and they were gone. They took your money, you fucking dummy. That's why there's no flow for the hoes. I'm out too stoked.
Hi, my name is Rodney Graham, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the main event.
Starting this weekend, UBC basketball is back on CITR. On Friday, November 7th, the men's and women's teams kick off their regular season against a longtime rival. At 6 p.m., the number 2 ranked women's team is in action against the Victoria Vikes in the first of a 2-game series. The men's team tips off at 8, and both games can be heard on 101.9 FM. On Saturday, the men's hockey team is back home to take on the Calgary Dinos. Currently in 4th place in the conference, the T-Birds will look to gain some ground on the 2nd place Dinos. Puck drop is at 7 p.m. on CITR.ca. You just gotta love sports.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 7th of November. I'm Marco Perdanovich.
And I'm Emily Blake. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:04 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science findings,
We also have a piece from myself discussing the unfolding of the Gian Gomeshi story with Ariana Barr, the coordinator of Volunteers in Outreach Education with Women Against Violence Against Women.
Later in the program, an interview with Professor Richard Sullivan from the School of Social Work on the state of child welfare in BC and across Canada, as well as a discussion with COPE candidate Yoruba Jamal, who is running for Parks Board in the upcoming Vancouver municipal election.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC Thunderbirds to get a new coach. On Monday, just 48 hours after the Thunderbirds' devastating 38-18 loss at the hands of the Saskatchewan Huskies, UBC fired head football coach Sean Olson. Although the Thunderbirds were nationally ranked at the beginning of the 2014 season, the team failed to live up to its talented core of players' initial promise, ending with a disappointing 2 wins and 6 losses. Over 5 seasons, Olson mustered 10 wins and 30 losses with the Thunderbirds. A former Thunderbird quarterback himself, Olson was hired as head coach in 2010, leading the team through a turbulent period where UBC considered leaving the Canadian Inter-University Sport, CIS League, for the more competitive National Collegiate Athletic Association, NCAA. Olson also served as coach during UBC's sports targeting review, when several of the university's athletic programs faced possible termination. UBC has already begun its search for Olson's successor, hoping to change the Thunderbirds' prospects for next season. After being fired from the team, Olson said, quote, "I know what the job is and that wins and losses matter," adding that, quote, "We didn't have the season we needed to have and there are ramifications."
UBC to waive tuition for some students. 17 UBC students who received financial assistance under the provincial government's youth care will now have their tuitions waived. In British Columbia, all support for youth in care ends at 19. Every year, about 700 youths age out of care and are statistically at risk of homelessness, early pregnancy, incarceration, and poverty, among other situations. The new policy is a response to BC's representative for children and youth, Mary Ellen Turple-Lafford, who encouraged the province's post-secondary institutions to support youth who are leaving government youth care by waiving tuition. 9 recipients this year were existing students and 8 are new students. There are 11 recipients at UBC and 6 at UBC Okanagan. According to the UBC, Darren Fernandez, Associate Director of Enrollment Services, stated, quote, "UBC recognizes that we want to provide access to education as much as possible for this community. We anticipate seeing the numbers increase and we welcome that. We want to make sure that we capture as many folks as we can and then provide additional support to them."
In local news, BC government may be working to privately shield gas industry from responsibilities. British Columbia is well known for its resource extraction and shipping industries, but this reputation has been increasingly sullied by dangerous spills and other accidents. In an effort to protect BC residents and the environment, groups including the Union of BC Municipalities have been pushing for a spill contingency fund, a pool of money funded by the province's oil and gas sectors that would be used to clean up future toxic spills. Increased response times and effectiveness of containment are just some of the benefits for having this funding set aside in advance. This past April, the province launched a public consultation process into its land-based response to spills, a process that ended in July. However, according to emails released through British Columbia's Freedom of Information process, government officials were discussing ways to exempt certain industries from the fund before the consultation process had even begun. The email exchange between a provincial environment official and 2 assistant deputy ministers reveals an attempt to redefine which substances would be described as toxic. Executive Director of the Environmental Ministry's Environmental Emergencies and Land Remediation Branch, Jim Hofweber, wrote that funding, quote, "would only be required for materials that are of high toxicity and persistence," adding that, quote, "this takes natural gas off the table, and possibly coal. Need some work on coal." Operators of natural gas pipelines and compressor facilities in the province would still need to respond to spills and report them, but the reclassification of their product would excuse them from paying into the proposed fund for all spills.
NDP environment critic Spencer Chandra Herbert remarked that this was an attempt to, quote, "let any company skate away from their responsibilities. While natural gas and coal may be less toxic than oil, they can still have a big environmental impact. This was exemplified last January when a freight train carrying coal derailed in Burnaby, sending several carloads into turbulency of a lake. Herbert added that the BC government's approach to polluter pay appears to be leaning heavily on the taxpayer to pick up the tab on those spills. One assistant deputy minister, Fazil Miller, was overt about wanting to really fund shutdown and favoring the natural gas industry. In 2012, BC and Canada's second largest producer of natural gas, with local companies producing 3.5 billion cubic feet of the local government prompting the sector's rapid growth, according to Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. In his email, Miller wrote, quote, "I am not having much luck coming up with any other language that will clearly protect the natural gas sector," and asking whether or not, quote, "value-added chemical products like methanol, ethanol, and urea would still come under the definition of high toxicity, or if they would also be protected." The discovery of these emails seems to suggest that the provincial government is more interested in protecting the province's economy than its environments. Herbert added that the revelation was, quote, "galling, but not surprising, given that they'd been saying one thing and doing another for years."
In national news, Remembrance Day approaches and poppies are making a comeback. According to Royal Canadian Legion officials, Canadians have already picked up roughly 19 million poppies, though the yearly campaign is only halfway through. Chairman of the Toronto branch, Jim Farrell, said that, quote, "Our volunteers on the corners say people have just been lining up for them," adding that he thinks, quote, "the events from a couple weeks ago brought the war home." Farrell was referring to the killing of Corporal Nathan Cyril, who was shot dead by a gunman at the National War Memorial on October 22nd, and the death of warrant official Patrice Vincent, who was attacked and run over by a terrorist. Legion officials say that those events have spurred a renewed patriotism, which is already taking the form of an increase in military support. Government officials expect the Ottawa ceremony to draw large crowds. Legion spokesperson Bruce Poulin said that, quote, "Vets returning from the war in Afghanistan, coupled with our being engaged with ISIS, plus the lone wolf terror attack on home soil, brought to life the risk of wearing a uniform. Canadians are showing their support, and it means a lot."
On Parliament Hill, there are renewed calls to make Remembrance Day a national statutory holiday, with a, quote, "Holidays Act" amendment passing with a vote of 258-2. Some provinces, including Ontario, made a conscious decision to have November 11th remain a regular school and work day. Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne spoke yesterday explaining, quote, the premier at the time changed it because he wanted to make sure that in schools, children learned about the meaning of Remembrance Day. What's important is that the day is an important time for people to acknowledge and honor those who have fought for us. Whether or not you agree with Canada's historical or current military involvement in conflicts around the world, we here at News 101 would like to encourage you to take a moment sometimes this week to pay your respects to the brave Canadian men and women who gave their lives. We would also like to remind you that the Remembrance Day ceremony at UBC will be held in the War Memorial Gym and that it begins at 10:45 a.m.
In international news, deployment of U.S. troops to Iraq escalates. U.S. President Barack Obama authorized an additional deployment of 1,500 troops to Iraq in order to retrain and advise the Iraqi military battling against Islamic State militants. Currently, the United States has approximately 1,400 troops in the region, with the new deployment nearly doubling their presence. Alarmed by the advance of Islamic State militants across Iraq, President Obama began sending non-combatant troops back to Iraq summer for the first time since U.S. forces withdrew from the country in 2011. One U.S. military official said one location military advisors would head to soon was western Anbar province, which borders Syria and where Islamic State fighters are still on the offensive. Iraq's main military divisions in Anbar have suffered high casualties. At least 6,000 Iraqi soldiers were killed through June, and double that number have deserted, say medical and diplomatic sources. The announcement came the same day that U.S. President Barack Obama met members of Congress at the White House, where he updated them on the fight against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The White House will ask Congress for $5.6 billion for the operations in Iraq and Syria, which includes $1.6 billion for the new Iraq Train and Equip Fund, the White House Office of Management and Budget said. President Obama has launched airstrikes against Islamic State targets in both Syria and Iraq, but he has ruled out sending ground troops into combat.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
You know, old girl, sometimes I think you're probably the finest ship ever to have sailed the Vortex.
Oh, I know, Doctor. This is the end of the world news.
So now we know.
Now we know for sure.
But why are they...
I'm waiting for you.
Indeed we are, Doctor. Thursday mornings from 8 to 10 a.m.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Our weekly Science and Technology Report segment with Marco. That's what's up next.
Good afternoon. This is Marco with your science news. In our lead story, Earth dodges a bullet. In late October, a bullet-shaped asteroid called 2014 SC324 made a close flyby with Earth. It was seen, or it was, the radar image was taken by NASA's DSN Deep Space Network as it flew by. The images show an asteroid with a rapid 45-minute rotation. Its shape was irregular and elongated. It was 197 feet long and 60 feet across. By the way, this asteroid was almost four times bigger than the Chelyabinsk asteroid that exploded over Russia in February 15, 2013. So as we all remember, that asteroid caused quite a bit of damage. So this would have caused a lot more damage. This was an Apollo-class asteroid. They follow orbits that occasionally cross Earth's path itself. Apollo-class asteroids are just one class of asteroids. There's three. There's two others. One is called Aten's class. It crosses Earth, but they have different orbital characteristics. And an Amor-type asteroid crosses a Mars orbit but misses Earth orbit. This asteroid was discovered with the Pan-STARRS 1 telescope on Mount Halakula on September 17th, so astronomers knew it was coming. In other local news, a UBC researcher, Professor Evika Rajkan Separovic, has made the headlines. She is leading a team of researchers that is finding genetic clues to intellectual disabilities in children. For most people with intellectual disabilities and their families, knowing the genetic cause of a disability is of great value, but standard chromosome analysis methods help diagnose only a few disabilities, such as Down syndrome. Many other forms of intellectual disabilities, therefore, cannot be found this way. Professor Rajkan Separovic has pioneered a new type of research and has taken on the challenge of finding genetic causes for intellectual disabilities that currently defy detection. She has assembled a group of 1,000 children from BC, and these children had no known causes for their intellectual disabilities. The professor said, and quote, "Previously children with developmental delay would only have chromosome testing, but chromosome testing, which involves microscope analysis, is low resolution, and an abnormality of a small segment of DNA can easily be missed. Researchers can get a better look at the chromosomes if they use the new process pioneered by Professor Rajkan Separovic. In her analysis, which is called chromosome microwave or microarray analysis, she compares patients' DNAs segment by segment to normal DNA. The mutations, such as duplicated or deleted genes, are highlighted by computer analysis, and they are finally found. Using this microwave microarray analysis, the professor found 150 defects out of the sample of 1,000 test subjects, children, that did have genetic defects. Okay. Two of the children in particular had a hidden genetic disability that became the key element to the research. In their long stretch structure of a single chromosome, revealed a single almost identical segment of genetic material was missing. This, with the report, it caught the attentions of geneticists around the world. So a database has now been made for 20 new cases that other professors around the world have identified. In other news, MINER shines an emergency response exercise. MINER, a machine called Mobile Imager for Neutrons for Emergency Responders, has been tested in the USA to search for nuclear devices that may be planted by terrorists in high-rise buildings. In the test, MINER shone, and Mark Goldsmith of Sandia Labs said, in quote, "The system performed exactly as expected. It found all the nuclear devices within half an hour. MINER is a portable neutron scanner camera which detects fast neutrons emanating from a nuclear material to pinpoint a source." This new machine will help counter any terrorist threats if they exist. MINER can be set up and taken down in 10 minutes, and it is battery powered. This is Marco. You have been listening to the latest in science and technology news.
Thank you, Marco. We are going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
For three decades, CITR's annual Battle of the Bands Shindig has been host to local bands known and unknown. This year, Shindig leaps into its fourth decade as 27 bands prepare to take the stage. The stakes are high, with artists competing for studio recording time, event showcase spots, and more. Shindig 31 marks CITR's first year at the Hindenburg, so come celebrate with cheap drinks, free pool, great stage, and of course, jokes for beer. Shindig runs every Tuesday until December 16th at the Hindenburg, 23 West Cordova. Cover is only $6. Shindig congratulates Revered for passing into the semifinals. This November 11th, come to the Hindenburg for the bright pop rock of Speller, the dark surf pop of Malk, and make sure you bring earplugs for Double Standards Hardcore.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at savecanadapost.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have a piece by news correspondent Emily Blake following public allegations of sexual assault against Gian Gomeshi. Emily interviewed Ariana Barrer, the coordinator of volunteers and outreach education with Women Against Violence Against Women, about issues surrounding consent and sexualized violence.
I'm here with Ariana Barrer, coordinator of volunteers and outreach education with Women Against Violence Against Women. Beginning late last month, it was announced that CBC had fired John Gomeshi, the host of the popular cultural affairs radio show Q. Following this, accusations of sexual assault by multiple women against Gomeshi became public. This has caused an increased discussion of issues surrounding sexual assault in the media. It has also prompted reaction on social media, including the hashtag #BeingRapedNeverReported, which went viral on Twitter. First off, do you see this case as opening the dialogue about sexual assault?
I think in an ideal world, the impact that sexualized violence has on women
every day of the year would be enough that we would see a big response from media, a big response from communities, a response from our government. We know that there's so many missing and murdered Indigenous women in this country. We know that, you know, one woman a week in Canada is murdered by her intimate partner. So we know that the rates of violence are so high already. And it's too bad that it does take sort of a celebrity to really draw this out. But I think we have already been seeing an interest in sexualized violence because of the rates of violence on campuses across the country as well. So I'm glad people are talking about it. I'm glad people are talking about it in some more responsible ways now. So it's about Dion. It's also not. Of course, we want him to do better. We want him to be accountable for what people are saying about what he's done and for him to make amends.
There's been a lot of discussion and questioning about the reasons why women don't report. If you could provide some insight into this question.
So there's lots of reasons why women don't report, and all of them are legitimate. Women might not want to go through a legal system that will not hold them at the center of that process. They give up a lot of power and control over that process when they go through the police, if it even gets to court, and they may have to retell their story again and again, and that can be really difficult, and sometimes women want to move on. Sometimes their idea of justice isn't their perpetrator behind bars. It might be something completely different. And sometimes we love or care about our perpetrators, and so we want to see something else for them. Sometimes we're financially dependent on our perpetrators, a whole bunch of different reasons. Women also don't want to be blamed for what happened. Any survivor of violence doesn't want to be impacted by victim blaming, and we know that we have a culture that often jumps to the defense of perpetrators or doesn't give credibility, particularly to women, and particularly to racialized populations or the Indigenous population here or to trans women. So it can be quite dangerous for people to come forward, and they might worry that police won't believe them, that their communities won't believe them or be able to support them in the ways that they can. And sometimes they just want to move on and heal. So there can be lots and lots of different reasons.
In the Gameshi case in particular, he initially released a statement on Facebook stating that all of his sex was consensual. This statement has now been criticized for using stereotypes of the jilted ex and vengeful women, which has raised issues of how the public discusses sexual assault. If you could expand on this issue.
So those are really tired stereotypes that it looks like he was trying to evoke. We know that this is actually a vastly underreported crime. We know that actually it's less than 1% of the population that falsely reports that. It's not like what we see in the media and on TV where it's used as a plot twist, like, oh, she was lying. That's really not what happens in real life. In real life, it's actually very difficult for people to come forward. And we know that particularly when we have powerful men or celebrities, that they hold a lot of credibility. They hold the appreciation of the public. And so if a woman is going to be coming forward, she's got that much more of a barrier in front of her than we already do when we want to speak out.
Could you speak further about the issue of consent? This story has raised a lot of questions about what exactly and what is not consent.
Only ongoing, continuous, enthusiastic yes is consent. Yes looks like a lot of different things, but it always must be clear, very clear. And there's some campaigns that have come out. Consent is sexy, which is great. And I think it's opening up a lot of discussions around how sexuality can involve communication. And it doesn't have to be some kind of imagined awkward conversation. It can be a part of what is so sexy and fantastic about consenting adult sexual relations. And the other thing is that consent is mandatory. So whether or not it's sexy, it's mandatory. And it's mandatory ethically and it's mandatory legally. So there's also campaigns that say yes means yes. So only yes means yes. And there's other campaigns that say no means no. And both are important. It's incumbent upon whoever is seeking out the sexual encounter to ensure that they do have that enthusiastic yes. And it cannot be through any kind of pressure or threat or force or intimidation of any kind or coercion. And it must be freely given and ongoing. So a person cannot be unconscious and give consent. That's not a thing. And you have to be able to give it and take it away at any time without the threat of consequences. I think we can do a lot better to create relationships where that's built in, where that's a part of how we are with each other, where we value our sexual partners and other people, period, as much as we value ourselves, where we're not putting our own sense of entitlement or what we want or our needs above others. And then we'll be okay. And we'll be having lots of great sex.
A lot of people consider this to be a women's issue or something that only happens to women. If you could address this issue.
Certainly it's not a women's issue. It's everybody's issue. And it's everybody's responsibility to do something about it. And it's everybody's opportunity to do something about it. living in this rape culture, which is that set of values and beliefs that allows this to be so rampant, you know, 1 in 3 women or 1 in 6 or 1 in 8 men, we know it's so common. And it's this attitude and belief system that we have that allows us to do that to other people, that we feel entitled to other people's bodies. And of course, we're not entitled to sex. We're not entitled to exert power over others and to do violence to each other. And so those attitudes and beliefs can change. We do know that a huge amount of sexualized violence is perpetrated by men against women. And that's really significant. And people are really looking at the role that masculinity plays and the kind of masculinity that we're creating in our culture, which is one that is connected with violence. Also a femininity that is about being groomed for acquiescence and for trying to do whatever it takes to please others. And of course, we're all more interesting than that. And we all have all kinds of gender expressions, and that we all have different traits and different characteristics. And we should be able to freely express those and not have violent consequences for that.
What changes do you think need to take place to have a positive impact on these issues?
I think we can start at the top. I think we can demand better from our leadership. But at the same time, we don't have to wait for leadership. We can, in all of our everyday lives, do something about everyday sexism, everyday racism, everyday homophobia, ableism, all of those things. We can choose to not participate in that. We can think about the language we use. We can think about how we support survivors in our community and making sure people know that we are willing to listen to them, believe them, and just let them know what options are out there. We can also hold the men in our lives accountable for what they do.
And is there anything else that you think is missing from the conversation?
Yeah, it's great to be asked about the context of sexualized violence, like what's going on in our culture and what we can all do about it. It's really refreshing. So often we just hear the same stuff about, you know, why women do or don't report, or what should women do or not do. And we really want to make that conversation about what should men do or not do, what should potential perpetrators not do, and what should we all do or not do in order to make sure that this is an issue that's going to decrease and decrease and decrease until we're all out of jobs. Because I would rather not have to work at a rape crisis center. I would rather live in a society that doesn't have a huge problem with rape.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have an interview with Professor Richard Sullivan from the School of Social Work on the state of child welfare in BC and across Canada. On Friday, October 31st, the Globe and Mail published an article that brought to light some serious flaws in the way child welfare services were being provided in Manitoba, with many children being housed in hotels rather than home settings. In March of 2014, the average number of children in hotel care were 65. A private company, Complete Care, in-home and hospital health services, provides the care for these children, with the province spending $6.4 million in 2013 to 2014 for this service, up from $4.4 million in 2012 to 2013. There are many significant issues with housing children in hotels, from a lack of qualified workers and lack of supervision to the simple fact that hotels are not homes. Although this is not an issue limited to Manitoba, it is a bigger problem in that province due to the extremely high number of youth in care in proportion to the province's population. Manitoba currently has more than 10,000 children in care out of a population of 1.2 million. Ontario, on the other hand, has 16,000 children in care, 1.6 times more than Manitoba, but has a total population 11 times greater. To discuss this in greater depth, News correspondent Morgan Yee spoke with Professor Sullivan in his office earlier this week.
Well, let me just start by saying that I think the problems in Manitoba and in BC and elsewhere, where children are ending up being placed in a motel with a homemaker or some hired caregiver has to do with the shortage of qualified foster homes, that is, foster homes that have passed a reasonable standard of inspection and so forth. Recruiting foster homes gets harder and harder because the whole foster home movement in the history of child welfare started when fewer women were in the workforce. So this was a service that was provided by stay-at-home moms. And female labor force participation has had the consequence, as that has gone up, then the availability of foster homes has gone down. There's also been the whole family preservation movement, which is about trying to keep kids out of care and in their own homes. One of the unanticipated consequences of that is that we often bring children into care later. And as a result of the living in challenging circumstances for a longer period of time, they have behavioral problems and developmental problems that make it harder to find appropriate caregivers for them. And what we have not achieved in Canadian child welfare yet is the full professionalization of foster care as a profession. So if we're going to ask people to care for children with serious behavioral and developmental problems, then we have to be recruiting those homes at a level of competence and ability to address those developmental and behavioral problems. And then we would have to pay them at that level. So it is a lag in the professionalization of foster care. And it has always historically been an efficient solution to the problem in the sense that they were not really paid. They were given a stipend to cover the cost of having that child in their home, but it was really voluntary. It was really like a volunteer activity. As the children have come into care later and with more problems, then you have to pay them for a higher level of care and then build on their experience and provide training for them so that they can provide adequately for these children. So then you're looking at a higher level of qualification that has to be screened for. And because we're not yet at the point of really paying for that or developing it as a service, there is this tremendous shortage. Much is being made in the media about the kids in Manitoba being in hotels. That has happened here. It has happened here, and in not just in child welfare, but also in child and adolescent mental health, where there have at various times been a bed shortage, and so you've had a child who probably ought to have been in inpatient care, who instead was for a short period of time at least in a hotel or a motel with a homemaker.
How common of a practice is that? Does that happen quite often?
No, it's an overflow. It happens when you've got you're so short. You're so short of inpatient beds, or so short of foster care beds, and you just simply don't have anywhere else to put them. So it is never intended to be more than a stopgap measure. Sadly, what has occurred in the case of Manitoba, it is becoming almost a habitual practice of that is now a form of care. Everybody is in agreement that that's really not adequate. That's no approximation of a home. And one of the things that's adding to the numbers that are mentioned in Manitoba, and Manitoba's not alone in this, is that if the preference particularly for First Nations children and youth is to place them within their own communities first, but where the number of people coming forward to provide that care is even smaller. But the numbers in the more First Nations populous provinces, the proportion of First Nations children needing care out of the home is higher First Nations people are 5% of the population of BC, but they're about 45% of the children in care. So recruitment has not been all that successful within their own communities. And so cultural value of community care and the whole community caring for the child, the value may survive, but the capacity to deliver on that value may not have.
Now, do you think that has to do with the level of training that some of these families have, that social workers are less inclined to place children with, say, with an auntie or uncle who doesn't necessarily have the training that would be required to become like an official foster parent?
The criterion that are used for kith and kin placements are typically lower.
Okay. Is there funding for kith and kin placements, or is that different from a foster parent?
There have been enough problems with kith and kin placements. There have been enough problems with that they weren't screened adequately. They thought, as long as it's within their own community, it's got to be better. These folks are related to them, so that's got to be a good thing. You're preserving family relations and so forth. But there have been enough disasters from that. Until fairly recently, a way to keep the numbers down, because you weren't actually bringing them into provincial care. It was almost like an income assistance program. And so the pay level for kith and kin was way lower than foster care. But they weren't being screened as carefully. They weren't being supported. They weren't being trained. It was as if somehow the cultural continuity would compensate for whatever else might have been missing. And when you think about the sort of problem profiles of First Nations communities and the cumulative trauma and experience that those communities have been through, then the number, it's just reasonable to expect that the number of homes that are in good shape and can expand their boundaries and provide care for their kin, as resources, they're overstretched. And it is not an inexhaustible resource. Another sort of solution that has not worked out so perfectly is to have a separate Aboriginal authority in child welfare. And those budgets are sometimes done proportionately, but even that may not be adequate. The BC Union of Chiefs, for example, a few years ago, they vetoed the implementation of a separate First Nations Child Welfare Authority in the province that was going to be parallel to MCFD.
Okay.
And they did it because they said, if 45% of the children in care are Aboriginal, then we want 45% of MCFD's budget. And they didn't get it, and they vetoed the implementation of a separate authority. I would argue that even a proportional budget is not enough, that you may need needs-based budgeting that would say, what is it that this community will need in order to provide adequately for its care, for its children, and for those who are in substitute care, what would be necessary to create the infrastructure and the service base that would enable that to be an adequate system. The other challenge that I think Canada has to face on this one is the question of the effectiveness of what is essentially an apartheid system. To create a separate but equal Aboriginal child welfare system for First Nations people. It's easy to understand their aspirations to want to do it on their own. That the mainstream community has not historically provided well or adequately for their children, I think that is simply a given. At the risk of sounding terribly cynical about it, I would think that since the child welfare portfolio is a hot potato for government, that if they can transfer it over to the First Nations, it insulates the provincial and federal government, but provincial government even more, because that's where the jurisdiction sits for child welfare. It insulates them from the political risks of Aboriginal child welfare. And then if it goes badly, they can go, well, it wasn't us this time. They did it to themselves.
And now, how would that differ from delegated aid? Down here, there's Backpass, Squamish Nation has one. So how is that different than having just like an overarching separate system?
There are some critics of the existing delegated authorities who would argue that that is still a colonial instrument. It's still following the same legislation. It's following the same implementation of that legislation. So since the fundamentals of the system are so close, that this is just a further...
Like entrenching further, it?
Yeah, it's an entrenched instrumentality of colonialism. And Barbara Waterfall, who writes in this area, makes a very good argument that since there are more children in care outside of the Aboriginal community than were ever in the residential schools, this is just the modern-day iteration of that old colonial instrument. The counter-argument is to use that argument then to say, well, the province needs to keep its hands off of First Nations children. Well, are you then consigning those children to a lower standard of care than the rest of the province?
Going back to looking at how funding needs to be increased for foster parents who are working with higher-risk youth,
yes,
and even looking at needs-based funding, I guess, do you think it's likely that the government would ever move to that?
We do have a formula in place for those levels of care, and the more complicated the child's requirements, the higher the level of compensation for the foster parent. However, and I've done several reviews in recent years where that levels system was used as a way to give people more money to retain them without necessarily improving their qualifications, without necessarily giving them more training or more support to do a harder job.
Is the child then not necessarily having better outcomes?
They're not having better outcomes. The reviews that I've conducted, the reason that I was conducting the review is because they were tragic outcomes. And they were using the level system to pay people to be over-census, to overcrowd those homes. And so, no, the standard of care was not being met. So I think that we have to come up with a whole different way to recruit foster homes and to support them and to train them and to recognize we are asking from people a professional service. We will have to pay them in a way that is commensurate with that.
We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Panzine West is Canada's largest zine and alt culture festival. $5 entry gets you access to underground zines, comics, and micro press from across Canada. This year features Mimi Pond, author of Over Easy and writer on Simpsons and Pee-wee's Playhouse. Also featuring Leanne Prain and fiction from Janine Allison. The 1-2 punch book pitch will let audience get live feedback from our judges. Panzine West is Saturday, November 8th, 1 to 7 p.m. at the Goldcorp Center for the Arts, 149 West Hastings. Visit brokenpencil.com for tickets and info, or look up Broken Pencil on Facebook or Twitter. Sponsored by CITR.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Marco Perdanovich. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us. Up next on the program, we have COPE candidate Aruba Jamal and news correspondent Constantine Perdanovich live in the studio.
Aruba Jamal is an outspoken campus activist, unapologetic student journalist, and leftist pundit. She is a former residence advisor and has held numerous executive positions in clubs on campus. And earlier this year, she helped co-found The Talon, UBC's new student alternative publication. She is now adding politician to that long and impressive resume. Aruba is running for a spot on Vancouver's Parks Board with COPE, the Coalition of Progressive Electors. She's here with me now. How are you, Aruba?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Do you feel any animosity about being called a politician? Or is that a fair title?
To be honest, it's not what I refer to myself as. But I guess it's pretty accurate.
What would you label yourself as?
If you... I guess that's the thing with COPE, right? The reason why I decided to run was because I didn't see them as a typical political party. As someone who hasn't really considered going into politics, electoral politics, and someone who, you know, hasn't really felt represented within the realm of electoral politics at in general, and as someone who, like, is essentially new to the municipal politics scene, it was kind of a very interesting decision for me. But as I learned more and more about COPE's platform, as I learned more and more about the fact that, you know, the membership of COPE, which is essentially are, like, the citizens of Vancouver, which are essentially the most, like, marginalized peoples in the city. You know, COPE's membership is made up of, like, working class people, made up of Indigenous people and people of color, and you know, people in the city that are finding it that the city is becoming increasingly unaffordable and inaccessible. So yeah, just reading through the platform and the fact that it was made up by all of these people, and just realizing that it's not, you know, your typical electoral party, that it's actually a party that believes in grassroots organizing, that believes in people power. And so I'm really humbled to be running along with all the other COPE candidates who are social justice organizers, right, in one way or another, who are committed to anti-oppression principles in one way or another. So
I guess that leads very well into one of my first questions. I mean, you've famously established yourself as a vocal campus activist through your involvement and your writing. And I'm wondering, did your activism, I guess it did, how did it inform your decision to run for the Parks Board?
Yeah, I mean, the two are definitely intertwined. I guess, like, specifically through the Talon, I've been able to see how when, like, a group of people that are, like, passionately committed to social justice and anti-oppression, when we come together, we have the ability to, you know, mobilize other students on campus. That, you know, we've been seeing that through a lot of the I'm a Student protests and organizing, through which, you know, the Talon has served as a central access point. We've been able to shift a lot of conversations on campus through our articles. And yeah, so we've been working towards, like, hopefully implementing some real changes. And so I guess, like, it was through working with independent grassroots work, such as the Talon, that really informs my understanding of COPE itself and, like,
right,
the power that they have to, like, ignite change and stuff. So
a huge focus for you has been targeted at youth. Why is youth such an important part of the equation to you?
Well, first of all, the reason why I think that I'm able to run with COPE in the first place is because at COPE I do feel that youth aren't tokenized. You know, we're not just, you know, there's not just a subcommittee that's like the youth committee and, you know, the rest of the party is enacting policies that are actually really not beneficial to a lot of youth in the city and that are, you know, pushing youth out of the city. With COPE, myself and Ilana Schechter, who's another UBC student that's running in the upcoming elections, we actually have the ability to, like, drive our visions forward, to drive what we, like, our platforms and essentially voice our opinions, you know.
Right.
And Alex Zatorniki is a member of the COPE executive, and she just joined, like, a few months ago, but she's on the executive team of COPE now, and she's also a UBC student, and also super heavily involved, and she's the one who got me involved in all this stuff, so shout out to Alex. But yeah, it's just, like, the fact that even the other COPE executive members are fairly young people who are actually shifting conversations in the city and, you know, changing policy Absolutely. Directions. And it's just really cool to see. And I guess I really wanted more of that to happen in the city. And people have told me, like, you know, the fact that, I mean, I guess it's a little bit of a, it sounds a bit pretentious, but the fact that I am running has inspired others to think about the role of youth in politics and how we can get more involved.
You know? I don't think that's pretentious at all. I mean, I'm interested to hear about what barriers are there for youth in Vancouver? I mean, there's a lot of them, but what do you see as the biggest barriers for youth getting involved and getting themselves heard in this city?
I think one of the biggest ones is that perhaps even just like knowledge building. I think sometimes the terrain of electoral politics and civil politics can seem a bit complex. And so I think that's where I see the role of alternative media to come in as well, where we can build that capacity, that knowledge building capacity through, just talking about like the basics of what is going on in the city, why things are the way they are. And this is information that you might not find on like other media outlets as well. So I guess like that would be kind of one of the barriers that perhaps prevent someone from being involved in this realm of like it's essentially could be preventing someone from being involved in municipal politics. And I guess one of the things we often hear is like, oh, youth are so apathetic, why aren't they voting? But I think that really bugs me, because it's not that we're apathetic, it's not because we don't care about the issues, it's mostly because there, for someone like me, I don't really see viable options when we have, you know, a two-party system, for example, when we have a stronghold in civic politics, where our only real options are two parties that are, you know, essentially not adding too much to the conversation and continuing to produce the same effects in the city again and again, you know?
And I guess to narrow down this youth demographic that we're talking about, we have a massive portion of the municipal youth vote literally here under our noses at UBC. And I'm wondering, as a student, what would you say to other students who perhaps, like you were mentioning before, might feel disassociated from this process? How would you encourage them? If you could say anything to them right now, what would it be?
I guess it would be to just like get involved. Right.
I guess a lot of it, what you were saying before, you mentioned a lot of alternative media sources.
Yeah.
Is that, what sorts of outlets would you deem, where are you getting this information from? Where should we be getting this information from other youth? I mean, we seem to be, there's a lot of youth empowerment from other youth. And I think that's what COPE's platform has been trying to get across the whole time. I mean, am I right in this to be mentioning that?
Yeah, definitely. As I mentioned, like, it was because of, you know, Alex involved with COPE, seeing Ilana run as well. And it's kind of was this domino effect into thinking about my own decision to run and being like, oh, hey, like, if these folks are involved, then perhaps I can also be involved. Mm-hmm. And actually, I just want to go back to that barrier question, because it just reminded me of the fact that a lot of the young people in the city, especially students at UBC, for example, can't actually vote in the municipal elections, which is like a huge issue.
Why is that?
Because the university sits on the endowment lands, right? So it's actually technically a part of a different electoral district.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned of that pretty recently myself.
Right.
And so when I was talking to a lot of my friends who live on campus and telling them about my campaign and my decision to run and all that, it came to the fact that they actually can't even vote for me. So I guess, like, in the sense, there needs to be conversation about why that is, and the fact that those that represent us here at UBC, why they're appointed and not elected, and
Right. Just to round things off, I mean, here's one of those fluffy mayoral debate style questions for you. What does your ideal Vancouver look like? That's very broad, and I understand that.
Well, I mean, I guess my ideal Vancouver would consult with the communities a lot more. The decisions that are made would be based on what the community wants. It would be a hell of a lot more affordable, and definitely more accessible for all sorts of folks with different, you know, of different backgrounds and different experiences.
Well,
and
I don't think anyone would argue with that. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks, Costa, for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So Aruba's platform for all of you can be found at cope.bc.ca/Aruba if you'd like to read more. And for the sake of full disclosure, News 101 did try to contact youth representatives from both Vision Vancouver and the NPA, but there was no one available for comment. Thank you so much for being with us. We're just going to go to a quick PSA break. Stay tuned right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
I got a stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
That's our program for today, November 7th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Marco Perdanovich.
And I'm Emily Blake. Today's broadcast was produced by Morgan Yee. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Up next, stay tuned for a sports broadcast.